Previously
on Beta.
Find anything? Didn't think so. Let's go, huh?
I know a thing or two about a thing or two. I sure do.
I'm a chicken lady!
A chicken lady?
Yeah, and I love life! Do you love life?
Oh, yeah.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, writer Brian Broom talks about his poetic and powerful memoir in which he explores blackness, addiction, and masculinity.
You don't have to be this paragon of masculinity. You don't have to be this tough guy. You can be anything you want. You know, this is your life, and you are entitled to all the experiences of the human condition.
Also, Stephen Hall on his mysterious, surreal novel, Maxwell's Demon, which will have you questioning the very meaning of reality.
I think maybe there's a sense as you get a little older in life, you have an age of great certainty, and then as you get older, you sort of start to suspect that the world is quite an odd place and odd things happen.
But first, comedian Trevor Moore. He's a founding member of the sketch comedy troupe, The Whitest Kids You Know. After killing it at the Aspen Comedy Festival, The Whitest Kids launched their own TV show. The show had many viral hits, but none more so than Trevor's It's Illegal to Say sketch that became the centerpiece of a significant Supreme Court case. Now Trevor hosts The Trevor Moore Show on Comedy Central. It has the vibe of a late-night talk show and an ambitious mission statement, solving all the world's problems. Trevor joined us from his home in Los Angeles, where he talks about who his late-night talk show inspiration is.
Well, when I was a kid, I loved David Letterman. Like, mm-hmm. When I was a kid, he was still on NBC, and I would, like, set the VCR to record him, because I wasn't allowed to stay up and watch it, but I'd watch it when I got home from school the next day. So I've always been obsessed with the late night format. I actually worked on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno for 5 years. I was like a correspondent for them. So like I had two different bits, and every month I would go out and do like twice a month I would go out and do like a man on the street kind of routine for them.
What's your name?
Nolan.
Nolan.
Easton.
Easton, nice to meet you.
Nice.
Trevor.
Nice to meet you, Trevor.
Do you guys work out at all?
We do.
A lot of people, the complaint they have about working out is that it can be kind of lonely. If you go to the gym, a lot of times it's hard to find equipment that's next to each other. We've invented something so that while you're working out and building your body, you're also building your friendship as well. Okay, this is the Buddy Glide. And how it works is when one person pushes, the other person pulls. You want to go all the way down so you really feel that burn. That's great.
I grew up watching, you know, all those things, and I loved it. So it's kind of fun to do it. Although I guess everyone has a show now. It's sort of
yeah, exactly. Just like everyone has a podcast.
Yeah, talk shows are like tattoos, where it used to be like kind of like whoa, like, but now it's like it's weirder if you don't have a talk
yeah.
show.
Exactly. It reminds me. There's that famous New Yorker cartoon. I think it's by Joe Dader. A guy and this woman are sitting in a coffee shop, and the guy says to the woman, "I'm thinking of stopping a podcast." That pretty yeah. much sums it up.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Blair Saki and Sam Brown played the Ed McMahon, Andy Richter type roles for you on the show. We know you worked with Sam on The Whitest Kids You Know, but can you tell us a bit about your relationship with Blair?
So Blair is just a hilarious comedian who I had never met until she came on the 24-hour show. Every hour in the show, we would do a different thing. And we were talking about the singularity and like AI and whether or not, you know, AI will like, you know, overtake mankind in the year 2045, which is what like Ray Kurzweil has predicted. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a very like kind of heady sciencey hour. You know, we had all these like computer guys on and stuff like that. And Blair was on, and she just like, she made the whole hour hilarious because she just didn't care about the computers. She just kind of cut through it all and was just making jokes the whole time.
And yeah. It is learning that in being part of that society, you get rewarded for good behavior.
Okay.
And who doesn't want to be rewarded?
Blair, what do you think?
I'm just glad that it's going to be 27 years from now where I'm going to be old and that I get to be young and hot now. And so that when I am brutally murdered, by your robots, it won't matter as much, you know what I mean?
It just kind of worked so well that when they asked me to do this thing regularly, I was like, well, what about having Blair as the co-host? Because she's hilarious.
Yeah. In the first episodes of season two of The Trevor Moore Show, you explored the question, is this joke offensive? How does looking at this question help solve all or maybe just some of the world's problems?
You know, there's a big thing right now where I guess it's sort of like a mini culture war where people are like, you know, oh, people are too sensitive right now. And then the other people are like, no, they're not. You just, you know, aren't adapting. And then there's an argument over, you know, the whole cancel culture thing. Is it real? Is it not? There's a big, like, you know, it seems to be there's every week there's a new article written about it. You know, I can kind of come away from that thinking that comedy doesn't age well at all. It never has. So things change and there's no use complaining about, you know, every generation is going to kind of retool media to what suits them. So if you want to stay doing, you know, the jokes that were popular, you know, 20 years ago, you're probably going to be fine, you know, but you'll only be playing to that crowd, the crowd that was young back then. You're probably not going to get a lot of young people now to be interested in your stuff. I grew up, my parents were Christian rock singers, so I grew up in a very conservative household. I wasn't allowed to watch many TV shows or movies. Like, I couldn't watch like He-Man because it had magic in it. I couldn't watch Smurfs because it had magic in it. And so there's a lot of stuff from my childhood that people are nostalgic for now that I've never seen. Like I saw Ghostbusters for the first time when I was like 35.
Wow.
And I didn't really care for it. And it's because I didn't have the nostalgia for it. So I'm seeing it now. And the jokes, the process is slow. The jokes don't really seem that funny. And it's because things don't age. You know, like stuff from a long time ago, you know, seems slow paced and stuff like that. And there's also tonal jokes that, you know, that don't really adapt. So so I guess a long way of saying is I don't think it's a problem. But I also don't think the people who made those jokes that are offensive now are monsters for having made them 20 years ago.
You also talked to a couple of comedians about how it's natural that offensive jokes often pop up after a tragedy. Why do you think we need bad jokes in times of trouble?
I mean, I think that's just a human release. You know, I think gallows humor is very important.
Mark, what do you think about crossing the line? Is there a line?
I mean, taking a risk of a joke bombing is kind of like the whole point. But like, I think Blair is right. As long as you don't write it down, like people, when you tweet a joke, people treat it like it's an iTunes service agreement. They have to like click agree.
Right.
You have to absolutely agree with the premise of a joke, which is not the point of a joke at all. But yeah, I mean, some of my favorite, I love dark humor. I still remember where I was, or a week after Columbine, the Onion headline, Columbine jocks safely resume bullying. It just still makes me laugh.
And I think the thing that's interesting to me about that is how, when the Challenger happened, I was six. And within like a week or two, like kids on the school ground are making jokes about it. And then when you talk to other kids that are around the same age, they're like, oh yeah, this joke. They all heard the same jokes, which is interesting to me because this is pre-internet. It's not like Johnny Carson was saying Challenger jokes. It's not like you could do those jokes on like the radio or like, you know, television. So it's just almost like a pre-internet global network of schoolyard playgrounds where like kids, you know, because kids tell everything that they think is funny to their friends and it just spreads like that. But what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like how do you process all the horror and randomness of life and these accidents that can happen to anyone and are tragic, that could happen to you, but they didn't. And so that's all you can do is like joke around with people still around, like, well, we're still here. They missed us, you know, let's make light of it, you know.
Yeah, there but for the grace of God go I. I want to revisit this, follow up on this, what you told us about your childhood a a couple of minutes ago about your parents being Christian rock singers and denying you access to a lot of popular culture. As you mentioned, you didn't see Ghostbusters till you were 35. Do you think, how do you think like being denied access to this popular culture affected you as a comedian? Was it a good thing to be denied to this? Do you think it made you more original, or do you think it missing out on that kind of compromised your ability to be funny?
So there's definitely reference points that I wouldn't make, you know, like I to this day, I've never seen Goonies. So who knows how many Goonie references I've missed. I know it's a big thing. You know, I know there's a pirate ship involved at some point. Like, that's all I got. I don't know. I try not to be too pop culture based in comedy. And maybe that's a defensive mechanism. I don't know. I definitely think that, you know, because everything was very conservative and had to be very clean, you know, that pushes you in the other direction. Like, The Whitest Kids You Know was, you know, constantly getting flack for being a very dirty, very kind of blue sketch show. And I think that's just kind of natural teenage rebellion where you're like, well, I'm not allowed to do this. Now I'm not at home. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go crazy with it. But even in that show, we always tried to stay away from the pop culture references because, you know, we do a couple, but we never wanted it to be like a Saturday Night Live where it's like, you know, like if you watch a Saturday Night Live, a random episode of that from 10 years ago, you know, so many of these things are about like something that Beyonce said that week. And you're like, what? I like kind of remember that. Like, you know, kind of. So we try to keep it away from being too, hey, did you hear this? Did you hear this? You know,
It gives your comedy a longer shelf life.
Yeah.
One of these sketches is called It's Illegal to Say. Can you tell us a bit about this one?
So that's one. I'm parsing my words here because I don't know. You know, they actually, there was a Supreme Court case fought over that sketch.
Hi, I'm Trevor Moore. Did you know that it's illegal to say I want to kill the President of the United States of America? It's illegal. It's a federal offense. It's one of the only sentences that you're not allowed to say. Now, it was okay for me to say it right then because I was just telling you that it's illegal to say I really, really think someone out there should kill the President of the United States of America. That's illegal. Extremely illegal. Very, very illegal. But not illegal to say with a mortar launcher. Because that's its own sentence. It's an incomplete sentence, but it may have nothing to do with the sentence.
So it was that. It's this kind of wordplay bit that I'd written. And, you know, the network was nervous about it, so I called the ACLU. And I was like, hey, am I going to get in trouble for this? Is this fine? Can I do this bit? And they're like, we can't advise on that kind of thing. They're like, we're not allowed to, you know, tell you whether or not something is a crime. And but then they did say, but we would, if you did get in trouble, we would defend you. And I was like, well, okay, cool. That's enough for me. I guess I'll put it out there. And then, so it was a fairly popular sketch from our first season, like among the sketches. And but then a guy used the whole text of it word for word, but replaced the President of the United States with the name of his ex-wife that he was feuding with. And he put it on his Facebook. So then he was arrested. And then he said, his defense was, no, it was satire. I was just doing what the Whitest Kids did. And so they went back and forth, and went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
When writing in social media like Facebook, what is defined as a threat and what is protected by free speech? That was the question at the center of a case before the Supreme Court today. Jeffrey Brown has the story and a warning. This case contains some graphic language.
The thing that makes me laugh is that all the Supreme Court justices had to sit and watch our dumb sketch show. everyone had to watch that, like sitting, in their robes or whatever. And they ended up ruling that it was satire and it was comedy, and you could not, the guy couldn't get in trouble for that. So I don't know if it's a good outcome or a bad outcome, but that's what happened.
Yeah, that must have been pretty surreal while it was happening, eh?
Yeah, it was kind of like, well, I guess we're not going to get a bigger sketch than that, you know, something that goes in the national records.
Yeah. Another sketch that unfortunately is very timely these days is Be a Cop. Can you tell us a bit about this sketch?
That was a sketch where it was a recruitment for the police department, And all it was every time the police were doing anything, they were just firing their guns.
Are you tired of the same old boring day job? Then why not run away from it all and join the police force? The exciting world of law enforcement offers competitive pay and huge potential for career advancement. And there's much more to the force than ever before. Pursue such diverse fields as surveillance, traffic control.
It's weird that they're like, that's timely. It's like, but it isn't, because that was that joke made sense 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Like, but doesn't it seem to you that it makes more sense now even?
I mean, it does in the weird way that this is still happening. But I mean, like, You know, there is controversial. I mean, there was that guy in New York that got shot 17 times.
Mm-hmm.
Our commentary was on that stuff back then. It's just that it's still happening now, and you know, it seems that people have hit a tipping point on it, though. It seems like people are kind of like, okay, we gotta do something.
Yeah. Yeah. Besides solving all the world's problems, what is next for you?
So there's a Whitest Kids You Know movie that'll come out next year.
Ooh.
It's an animated film.
Why animated?
Because we wrote this movie that we love. It's like our favorite thing we've ever written. But then when we don't do a lot of self-checking, like when we're writing, we're like, what's the funniest thing? What's this? And then we look back at this thing, we're like, this is a $250 million movie. Like, there's so much crazy stuff in this. Like, and then, so then we started being like, all right, well, we could pull this back and be like, or we could animate it and then we don't have to pull anything back. We can do it. We can do all of this stuff.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it. And I imagine it's going to have a storyline, right? A plot?
Yes, it does. Yes. It's about a couple of billionaires race to put a city on Mars.
Ooh, okay.
I mean, that's the kind of line that we like to hit, where it's like, all right, we're not talking about Elon Musk, we're not talking about Branson or Bezos or any of these guys. Like, we're not going to get into, but we're going to talk about this. What's happening in society right now is like we're all these rich guys are about to start colonizing the moon, because. Mm-hmm. We think that's still going to be an issue 20 years from now.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not gonna age itself out quickly.
Mm-hmm. Trevor Moore, thank you very much for the great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You too.
Trevor Moore is a comedian, the host of The Trevor Moore Show on Comedy Central, and a founding member of the Whitest Kids You Know sketch comedy troupe. You can find out more about Trevor and his work at wpr.org/beta.
I was like watching TV at the time, and I saw these parents on TV who were super loving and kind and jokey with their kids. I didn't have that kind of relationship with my parents.
Coming up, Brian Broom talks about growing up in Ohio and his struggles with blackness, masculinity, and sexuality. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Growing up, it didn't take me long to learn that my gayness detracted from my blackness. Black gay men are punchlines to the black community, an anomaly to be ridiculed. Relegated to the role of church choir directors, we are a national family secret, courtesy of masculinity and religion.
That's Brian Broom reading an excerpt from his memoir, Punch Me Up to the Gods. When I started reading Brian's book, I felt like I was reading his diary. It's an incredibly intimate experience, and at times I felt like I was invading his privacy. But fortunately for us, Brian had the courage to share his life story. In the book, he revisits his childhood and his formative years growing up in rural Ohio. Along the way, Brian reveals heartbreaking stories about his status as an outsider trying to become part of the in-crowd. We learn about his efforts to soothe his soul with random sexual encounters and alcohol and drugs, and why he named his memoir, Punch Me Up to the Gods.
Basically, it's a rewording of something that my father used to say, but I think sometimes a lot of black parents say, like, I brought you into this world and I'll take you out. My father used to say that he would punch you so hard that you would go back up to God to be remade and reborn, so that you were made correctly.
Wow. So how did you feel when he would say that to you?
Well, I mean, I didn't really feel any particular way when he would say that, it was just an expression that was used in the house. So I knew it was a threat, but it was such a, it came with such regularity that I didn't really feel any particular way about it.
Mm. In your book, you don't shy away from sharing the most heartbreaking details about your life. How difficult was it for you to revisit all of these memories while you were writing the book?
It could get really difficult at times, like sitting alone in a room and trying to really get at the emotion that you were feeling at that time, whether it be embarrassment or shame or sadness. You want to tap into those emotions, and there's really no way to tap into those emotions unless you're kind of feeling them. So I would have to get really deep into the memory and try to feel the same way that I felt then. So at times that was pretty difficult to do.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine it would be. So was writing Punch Me Up to the Gods, was writing it cathartic for you in any way?
Oh, yeah. I don't feel like I have any more secrets. You know, since the book has come out, I've had to explain a lot of things to people in my life who are still in my life about my past, things that I didn't tell them. You know, they're reading them for the first time and they have questions. And I struggled with whether or not I was obligated to answer those questions for the people in my life. And I hope that the book answers some questions that they may have had. But for me, it's been, you know, revelatory. I feel a little bit freer in the world.
That's great. That's good to hear. Do you have a specific audience in mind for your book?
When I started writing the book, I really wanted to connect with young Black men and boys, like to, you know, just be a messenger in the sense that of telling them that, you know, you don't have to be this thing that the world keeps telling you that you are, whether that message comes from Black people or white people or anybody. You don't have to be this paragon of masculinity. You don't have to be this tough guy. You can be anything you want. You know, this is your life and you are entitled to all the experiences of the human condition. But then I think as the book has gotten out there, I'm hearing from a lot of different kinds of people who have felt as though the world was trying to place them in this box that they didn't fit into. I'm hearing from a lot of people who grew up with shame the same way that I did. So I'm hoping that now the book can reach people who maybe they feel this way in their own life, or maybe they know somebody who might feel trapped in their own life. So I'm hoping that it can reach different kinds of people at this point.
Yeah, I hope so too, because it's such a beautifully written and powerful piece of work. What were your relationships with your parents like?
Well, I mean, my father was a typical father for the time in the 1970s. He went to work. He worked really hard. He came home tired. He expected his dinner on the table. And he was the man of the house. And so he didn't really, you know, although I know that he loved us, he didn't really engage in the parenting part of that too much. That was, of course, up to the woman, my mother, who took care of cooking and cleaning and the nurturing. You know, my parents were very stoic, I remember, when I was growing up. There wasn't a whole lot of fun to be had, particularly, you know, after my father lost his job. It was, everything was based, basically went into household concerns, like how are we going to keep the lights on? How are we going to keep the gas on, et cetera? So it was run kind of like a business. And, you know, I was like watching TV at the time and I saw these parents on TV who were super loving and kind and jokey with their kids. I didn't have that kind of relationship with my parents.
Yeah. Yeah. And also they didn't get along well, especially after your father lost his job, right?
I don't know that they didn't get along well. They just didn't interact. You know, like I said, I mean, unless it was in terms of business. Here's money for the gas bill. Here's money for the phone bill. I didn't ever see them have any sort of like alone moments together or any affection between them. It was very, very officious, their dealings with each other.
How did your relationships with your parents, how did those relationships affect the way you thought about yourself?
Well, I don't know. I think that I just thought that this was the normal way that a family ran, or at least it was just the normal way my family ran. I didn't really feel like I had a whole lot of support because, you know, school, I think, was just a way for my parents to get rid of us for a while they did what they had to do. So they weren't really into my schoolwork. They were just busy. And I think it kind of left me to my own devices, which is when I kind of started scribbling and writing and doing things. I gave up on the idea of my parents sort of noticing me pretty early on.
Hmm. There's a beautiful chapter that you wrote from your mother's point of view. Why did you decide to write this chapter?
Well, basically, I think by the time I had gotten to that point in the book, I was just tired of my own voice. And I realized over the years, my mother and my relationship has gotten closer. I realized that her story is a significant part of my story. I mean, everybody's mother story is. And so I just wanted her in there. I wanted her voice in there to just give a broader picture. This is a memoir. And I think if anybody writes a memoir, they should include their mom's voice. Because if you want a bigger picture of yourself, talk to your mom. Your mom knows things about you that you don't even know. And I also just really thought it would broaden the scope of the narrative to hear from her and where she came from and what her hopes and dreams were.
Mm-hmm. It definitely did. I thought that was like a really brilliant move on your part to do that. Did you ever consider writing a chapter from your father's point of view?
I did. I did, really. And I'm still thinking about that. You know, maybe something in the future might include his voice. But at the time, I really don't know enough about my father to be able to write a chapter about him. For the chapter in Punch Me Up to the Gods, that is my mother's voice, I interviewed her and I talked to her about different points in her life and, asked her about things. My father and I never had a conversation where I could glean information about his life. The things that I've learned about him, I have learned from other relatives, and his upbringing wasn't great. And so I would really love to explore what made him the man that he was.
Mm-hmm. You cover your relationship between identifying as gay and the concept of Black masculinity. How has this intersection influenced the way you've lived your life?
Well, I think that I have grown up with a terror of being perceived as effeminate, because any sort of behavior that was considered feminine when I was growing up was just basically beat out of you or shamed out of you, because there's a stereotype. Uber masculine, cool, athletic, strong, and stoic man. And so I think that there are things in my life that I've avoided doing that I've really wanted to do that I didn't do because of the perception of being feminine. Which, you know, now at my age, it feels silly. But I think that there are things that I missed out on that I didn't do that, you know, writing was one of them, right? I didn't write for a very, very long time because my cousin told me when I was very young that it was quote unquote faggy to be sitting around writing. So I stopped. I think I probably would have written something much sooner had I not had that implanted in my brain at a very young age.
I was really struck by your confession that the biggest failing in your life has been your gasping need to be loved at the expense of so many other things. Can you tell us about this?
I think that I grew up thinking that the single greatest accomplishment a person could do was to be loved by everybody, to be liked. That meant that you were likable. That meant that you were lovable. That meant that you were worthy of love. I've since found out that in life, I think that if absolutely everybody likes you, you're probably a psychopath of some kind. I went out of my way to try to be all things to all people. I lied about, you know, my background. I lied about who I was. I just told these lies in order to make people like me or to make them think I was worthy of their liking me. And so I think I really did myself a disservice in doing that. I never really got to explore who I actually was because I was constantly sort of putting on these performances for whomever I was around at the time. That is where a lot of the drinking came in, because when I was drinking, I was a performing bear. I just was the life of the party all the time and everybody loved me. But when the bar closes, you're still as alone as you were before. And I think that it maybe goes back to your other question about, you know, my parents didn't really show me a whole lot of attention because they were very busy. I didn't feel loved. And so I think later on in life, I just went looking for it, no matter what form it came in, no matter if it was toxic, no matter if it was disingenuous. I just wanted that feeling of being accepted and taken under somebody's wing or something like that. And it just led me down a lot of dark places.
You include a very powerful quote from James Baldwin in your memoir. It's a quote I've never encountered before, and I was kind of embarrassed to admit that I hadn't read it. So thank you for introducing me to it. Would you mind reading it for us and telling us what it means to you?
Sure. The quote is, "The details and symbols of your life have been deliberately constructed to make you believe what white people say about you. Please try to remember that what they believe, as well as what they do and cause you to endure, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear." It's from The Fire Next Time. Black people have a very difficult time in this country. I think that, unfortunately, one of the functions of this idea of white people and black people is to ensure that white people always can feel better about themselves, no matter what. At least I am better than black people. This is something that I grew up with growing up and going to a predominantly white school. And I think that somebody once said, he was a white man who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, the idea is to make even the lowest white man still feel better than the highest black man. I think a lot of things that we're told about ourselves as black people in this country are profoundly untrue. We grow up under this idea that we are this other form of human being, that we're a different species and a lower species at that. A lot of things in America systemically are constructed to keep us feeling that way and to make sure that white people still feel good about themselves and superior at all times. I think a friend of mine once said to me, you know, white people are people. They get to just be people. And black people get to be this other thing, black people, which comes with this, a lot of other like attendant supposed characteristics or whatever that we have to contend with mentally. So I think that that's what that quote means. James Baldwin is talking to a young black man in it and saying, the things that you see around you are constructed to make you believe that you are something other than a full human being. Don't believe it. These things are constructed by people who thrive on you feeling as though you are less than.
That's right. Thank you. That was a very, very great analysis of it. And I think that's why it resonated so strongly with me. Yes. Near the end of your memoir, you confess that you have spent a lifetime giving up in one way or another, but you didn't give up on writing your beautiful memoir, which was receiving a lot of great reviews. Do you think that this marks a turning point in your life as you move forward?
Oh God, I hope so. I still struggle with that. Oh, you know, I'm not good enough. You know, I can't do this. I still do sometimes, but I do notice more times now where I am raring to go. I can do this. I can do this. And I've taken on more things that I thought that I couldn't do. I've been challenging myself more. So I do think that this book being in the world has broken something in me that needed to be broken, or maybe just hobbled it a little bit, you know, this insecurity around everything that I do. So I definitely am looking toward the future and looking for ways to challenge myself and to try not to be afraid to fail at things. I just feel like now I'm living more than I have been ever before in my life.
That's good to know. And you should be feeling that way. It's too bad you weren't feeling that way sooner, but better late than never. Brian Broom, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on Punch Me Up to the Gods. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Brian Broom is the author of the memoir, Punch Me Up to the Gods. You can find out more about Brian at wpr.org/beta.
In the plot, it also seems at several points that maybe Thomas has lost a day and arrived somewhere the day before he left, although we don't know whether that's really true or whether someone is messing with him.
Novelist Stephen Hall joins us to talk about his latest mysterious, mind-bending novel, Maxwell's Demon. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
When I was little, my father was famous. Dr. Stanley Quinn was a man of letters, a man of words, a man who'd built himself from clattering keys and spooling ribbon, and a firm yank on his own bootstraps to become the greatest poet, journalist, and war correspondent of his generation. In real terms, this meant I grew up without my father around, Although as I remember it, he always seemed strangely present. Throughout his many absences, my father endured as an active part of my life. His picture in the press, his thoughts in the broadsheet black ink that rubbed off on my fingers, his disembodied voice from inside our kitchen radio.
That's Stephen Hall reading the opening of his latest novel, Maxwell's Demon. It's the follow-up to his award-winning debut novel, The Raw Shark Texts, which came out in 2007. That book earned comparisons to Philip K. Dick and Haruki Murakami, as well as Jaws and The Matrix. Stephen continues to explore more uncharted territory in Maxwell's Demon. It has a similar vibe to Christopher Nolan's film, Inception. Stephen's wizardry with words and his obsession with big ideas, like entropy, will probably have you questioning reality. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We sat down with Stephen so he could share more about this mind-bending novel.
It's about a failed novelist whose father was very successful and his kind of feelings of being replaced in his father's affections by his father's assistant, who is also a successful novelist. And when we meet the protagonist, he's kind of languishing at home on his own, and he gets a series of strange messages. The first one that seems to be an answer phone message from his father, despite his father having died 7 years before.
Yeah, and then there's a message from his father's protege, Andrew Black, who is kind of a rival for his father's affections. Can you talk a bit about the message that Andrew Black sends to Thomas Quinn?
Thomas receives a letter from Andrew, and nobody's heard from Andrew in 6 years at this point. He wrote an extremely successful, multi-million selling whodunit and then disappeared. And as you said, Andrew has this complex relationship with Thomas, and Thomas hasn't heard from him. And then he gets a letter in the post, and inside it is a Polaroid picture of what looks like a black sphere, about as big as an orange, but that's utterly and completely black in quite a disturbing way. And a note that says, Thomas, do you know what this is?
Mm-hmm. And then things escalate from there. Where does the title of your book, Maxwell's Demon, where does that come from?
It's from a thought experiment in physics to do with entropy and thermodynamics. You know, the idea that entropy can only be decreased by applying energy, and that as a result, in some mysterious connection between entropy and time, we don't quite understand, time can only flow forwards because things are tighter in the past and messier in the future. And Maxwell's Demon is a very simple little thought experiment that shows that under the right circumstances, if a creature in the right place knows what it's doing, it seems to be possible to reverse entropy and therefore to reverse time.
Mm-hmm. And is it possible to talk about how that thought experiment, which it serves as the title of your novel, how Maxwell's Demon relates to your novel without giving anything away?
Yeah, I mean, it relates in lots of different ways. It relates kind of in terms of the themes of the novel, in terms of putting things right that have come apart, or finding a way to move back to a state of being that was before some kind of decay or entropy. In the plot, it also seems at several points that maybe Thomas has lost a day and arrived somewhere the day before he left, although we don't know whether that's really true or whether someone is messing with him.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to explore such weighty subjects as entropy, physics, theology, and technology in your book?
That's a good question. I mean, I thought maybe I'll try and write a more straightforward one after Rorschach texts, but I couldn't. I think partly Rorschach texts does a lot of different things at the same time, and I felt compelled to try and do a lot of different things at the same time again, but in a different way, and also to follow some of the ideas that I'd started to become interested in and to really push through some of the stuff that I'd start to look at in Rorschach. I guess Maxwell's Demon is kind of the second half of those explorations in some way. I'm sort of plagued by complexity. I can't help it. I become really interested in strange and esoteric things and complex things and strange ways of looking at the world. And I find that I can't help but kind of dig into them and kind of build things out of them. It's just my nature.
How much of the storyline did you know before you started writing it? In other words, how much of it did you have mapped out before you started writing? My sense is you wouldn't have that much mapped out. You kind of had to figure it out as you went along, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Not very much at all. And in fact, the book that became Maxwell's Demon was one quarter of a bigger book that I was writing. You know, Maxwell's Demon is very concerned with entropy and autumn, but there were also sections on spring, summer, and winter. And the whole thing become quite insanely gigantic. And I kind of plucked Maxwell's The Autumn Book, as I was calling it at the time, out of that and focused on that a little bit. And sort of found my way into that. But it changed a lot. It changed from the first draft to the second to the third. I mean, the ending, some of the reveals at the ending actually came quite late, like maybe halfway through writing the book. I sort of changed my mind on certain things.
You say that your novel is concerned with tricks that stories tell. And one of these tricks you identify is that, quote, the writer is setting the pace for the reader to travel at, but the writer does not travel at that pace, unquote. It seems so obvious once you point it out, but in all my years of reading, it's never occurred to me. And I found it a very fascinating concept. Can you tell us a bit about this?
I think that's the kind of thing that I'm drawn to, things that seem from a certain point of view, like, of course, you know that, of course, you've always known it. But if you stop and actually look at it and imagine what that means from the point of view we look in the book and from a practical point of view, it becomes something seems very counterintuitive. In the book, what I'm talking about is that a book is written for the speed that the reader reads. So you're constantly working through and you're reading what you've written back at the speed the reader would read it. In the book, Thomas talks about a path that's, you know, just the right, it's not got stones in that's going to trip you up on words or oddly built sentences, that you can move at what feels like the perfectly normal pace that, of course, you and the writer are both moving at. But actually, the writer's taking 10 times the time that you're taking to read that paragraph to write it, or maybe much more. And so there's this strange thing, again, it comes back to time and entropy, that when you're going through a book with a writer, you have this weird idea that the writer's actually aging 10 times faster than you as you're moving through the text.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a really neat lens to look through to explore the concept of time travel, which you do throughout the book. Does this have anything to do with why you include so many interesting typographical elements that resemble concrete poetry in your novel, which you also did in Ross Shark text? But many of these in Maxwell's Demon are in the shape of leaves, I would say the majority of them. And that probably has to do with the fact that of this being Maxwell's Demon originally being part of a larger book called Autumn. Can you talk a bit about the use of typographical elements in your work?
Yeah, of course. I mean, part of the reason they're there is because I really, in Rorschach, and again here, something I find really interesting is that contrast between what we imagine as we read versus what we're seeing. You know, it's really easy to kind of picture the story we're reading. I'm quite a visual reader, so I find myself setting a scene and a stage and putting characters in it, and it's almost like while I'm looking at the page and reading, I'm kind of seeing this film in my mind. And I know some people aren't that sort of reader, but I think a lot of people are. And I think it's quite interesting when you have visual elements on the page, it kind of counterpoints that, because what it does is it reminds you that you're not seeing those things. You're imagining those things. And so you're comparing and kind of contrasting the things you're seeing and the page itself versus what you're creating yourself inside your own head.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience for me because originally I had a PDF version of your novel. And so when I come to those parts, I'm reading it on my laptop and I'm, you know, turning it in the laptop in all directions. So the laptop got quite a workout. Yeah, definitely. So it's probably lost 2 or 3 pounds and it's, I don't know, 5 pounds to begin with. In your novel, Andrew Black tells the protagonist, Thomas Quinn, that the novel is an engine. What exactly does Black mean by this? And do you agree with Black's idea that the novel is an engine?
Well, in the book, Black has one very specific idea in mind for what this engine could drive and what it could achieve. But I think I was really interested in going to kind of religious and very old spiritual texts, that I was sort of interested in this idea of words creating the world. And I'd read somewhere and found it fascinating that, you know, in the Old Testament, when God says, let there be light, it's not until he actually says the word light and gives it a name that light can exist. And, you know, this very old idea of calling things into existence by naming them and commanding them with words. One of the things I wanted to do with this book was sort of build a mythology where I could play with that. And the more I went into these old religious texts, the more I found that it was already there. If you just knew what you were looking for, there were so many examples of it. And this idea that, you know, through reading and imagining is an act of creation, you know, and in these texts, not only in the mind, but kind of literally.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the examples that you found as you when exploring these texts. Can you give us an example of one of these examples?
One that I really love is from the Midrash texts, where the Yod is removed from Sarah's name by God. And so she becomes Sarah, her name changes slightly, and this little letter is furious, and it flies up in the face of God and demands to know what it was done wrong. Just because it's the smallest letter, how dare God remove it from this virtuous woman's name? Which is just fascinating that in the text, a letter gets to have an opinion. And the way that the letter behaves is very much like other creatures behave in those texts, which is where the book gets to.
Yeah, absolutely. In the acknowledgments, you say that you are indebted to two books, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell and The Writer's Journey by Christopher Vogler, and they are referenced in your novel. How did these two books help you to create Maxwell's Demon?
As you could probably tell by reading Maxwell's Demon, I'm fascinated by mechanics. Mm-hmm. My father's a mechanic, and I guess I've only just realized that I've sort of become a mechanic myself without realizing it. I'm fascinated by the way that stories work. Those two books, both very, very interesting on the way that mythic texts work and the way that our brains are designed to receive certain texts and how you see certain patterns repeating again and again. And I don't necessarily write wholly with those principles in mind or even majorly with those principles in mind, but it's very interesting to see that once you see how those books describe a story always has this sort of character who does this, and there's a character who usually show up whose job will be this. It's really eye-opening, like, oh, yeah, of course, and their job in the story is to do this, but also as an audience, as a reader, it's their job to let us know the stakes of this, you know, all this sort of thing. And that mechanical element is super fascinating to me, and I wanted to write a whodunit which lent into the mechanics of its own story, so I got very into those books.
Mm-hmm. The central question of the legendary sci-fi author Philip K. Dick's work is, what is reality? And this seems to me to be a central question in Maxwell's Demon. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. What is reality? And also, both of my books and a lot of things that I write, interested in the idea of what is reality, what is life, and is it possible to cheat it? How solid are those rules?
Yeah, I think you're right. Absolutely. You have an epigraph from Stephen King's novel 11/22/63, and I wonder if you'd mind reading it to us and then explaining why you chose it?
Sure. The world is barely there at all. Don't we all secretly know this? It's a perfectly balanced mechanism of shouts and echoes, pretending to be wheels and cogs, a dream clock chiming between a mystery glass we call life. How beautiful is that?
That's beautiful, and you have a beautiful reading too, yeah. Well, can you tell us why you chose it for this novel?
It encapsulates in the most beautiful writing what I was trying to get at in this book. I think maybe there's a sense as you get a little older in life, you have an age of great certainty, and then as you get older, you sort of start to suspect that the world is quite an odd place and odd things happen. You go through your life, and it's a life of weird coincidences and strange things. And I think you gradually start to suspect that, as Mr. King says, that the world is not as solid and real as it seems in some strange way that's hard to grasp, because of course it is, of course it's real, of course all science is real. I mean, I'm not saying that for a minute, but you almost develop a very strange double think that suggests there's some angle you're not quite seeing, or at least I have as I've got older.
Yeah, very well said. Stephen King includes your previous novel, The Raw Shark Texts, in the reading list of his book On Writing, which makes me wonder if or when you write a book about writing, what do you think the most important advice you give will be?
Man, there are so many things to say. I think the really important thing to do is always try and put yourself in the shoes of the reader, to learn the skill of going back through the text and reading it as though you don't know it, and allowing yourself to trip up and allowing yourself to kind of be confused and sort of separate what you know from what's on the page, which is a skill that's, you know, it's a technical skill, but it's so important. You have to kind of get out of your own head and allow yourself to be a little disappointed with what you've tried to do when you haven't succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Stephen Hall. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Stephen Hall is the author of the novel Maxwell's Demon. Find out more, or as much as we could figure out, at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Trevor Moore, Brian Broom, and Stephen Hall. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, Beta is now available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
And I see that Steven is back again this year. Hello, Steven.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Is that okay if I talk to Adam about this, or am I really, do we not want to do this anymore, this bit?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Please stop screaming at Doug.